Section number 12922, Squadron Leader Ronald Meredith, Reel 1.
Squadron Leader Meredith, Reel 1. So if I could ask you first of all then, Squadron Leader, about your background. You know, could you tell me where you were born and brought up?
Well, I was born in Peterborough in 1938. My father was in the Royal Air Force, and he was based at Halton at the time. Shortly thereafter, he disappeared off to war. And my mother and I moved up to Scotland, and I was brought up on the west coast of Scotland, where I spent virtually the whole of the war, until my father came back in 1945, and he was posted to Netheravon in Wiltshire, and we moved down. I went to school there, and then literally followed my father around the place until such time as I eventually was called up for national service myself in 1956. But in that time, I served with him overseas in Egypt and moved all around the UK, completing my education in various schools and finishing up at the Parston School in North Walsham in Norfolk, while I managed to obtain sufficient qualifications to get a cadetship. In fact, although I was called up for national service and was actually about to join the army, having got the results of the various examinations, I took a cadetship and went to Cranwell, although I must say my first priority at that time was actually to join the Navy, because I didn't have physics at A-level. I wasn't actually able to get into Dartmouth at that time, so I went to Cranwell and joined the RAF as a flight cadet at Cranwell in September 1956, and graduated from there in July 1959. My training at that time was orientated on what we would today call the logistics field. It was then called the equipment branch, became the supply branch, but essentially all the support side of logistics, supply, maintenance, engineering to a certain extent, but specialising for myself in the armament side, munitions, explosives and transportation. And in July that year I was posted to Scampton, just north of Lincoln, home of 617 Squadron, and I actually became the squadron sort of mobility officer, as it was just called, responsible at that time for opening up what were called dispersal airfields. Now, you must remember, in 1959, the Cold War was quite a big thing, and we were, you know, 3-minute, 4-minute warning was the panic cry. So to avoid all aircraft being caught in one heap, we had a concept of dispersal in those days, so that when threats were imminent, the aircraft could be deployed away from their home base to other stations in small packets and ready to deploy operationally from there. And I was responsible for opening up a dispersal at Lossiemouth, for example, which was then a naval air station, and at various other bases throughout the UK. At the same time, the squadron was heavily involved in exercises. I was with them going out to Cyprus, to the Far East, and out to Australia and New Zealand. In fact, we went out for the opening of Wellington International Airport in 59, bent a Vulcan out there. I was left behind to arrange for sort of recovery of the same aircraft, came back to UK, sent back the following year after the aircraft had been fixed by Avros. So I took trips to Australia with 617, New Zealand rather, which was rather nice. But also, bearing in mind that, say, it was a single station, a single squadron station at that time, we were gradually building up for two more squadrons. 27th Squadron was coming in, I think it was 83 Squadron, and they were going to be equipped with Blue Steel, which was the first UK nuclear missile. So I was heavily involved in that project. At the same time, scattered throughout East Anglia, you see these missile sites, which were actually American missiles, Thor missiles, which were operated by the Royal Air Force. And the warheads for these things used to come into Scampton, and I was, one of my other duties, was responsible for actually would offload these warheads from the American aircraft, and then we'd transport them out to the various sites around the UK. So I got involved in the nuclear field at a fairly early stage. From there, I was posted to the Middle East, a place called RAF Idris in Libya. which is now, of course, no longer. But in those days, the old king was on the throne, and Libya was actually quite a splendid place. In fact, we were ostensibly a staging post for aircraft going through to other parts of the world. And it really was marvellous. I was a 2IC on the airfield side, looking after the aircraft coming through, and I was also the port commandant down in Tripoli, which was jolly nice because one of my hobbies was sailing. And there was plenty of sailing. We had an RAF marine craft there. We used to bring in all our ammunition for the ranges through the docks at Tripoli. We had air-to-ground ranges out in the desert. And it was rather a superb posting, I must admit. It was unlike the other end of Libya, a place called El Adam, which was known as Marram with Sand. It was a it was isolated in the middle of the desert, whereas Idris was surrounded by trees and vineyards and fruit groves and things like this. And it was rather lovely. In fact, the officer's mess was an old Italian brothel. In fact, it was the officer's brothel, I think, we lived in. But it was beautifully appointed and very nice. But when that tour came to an end, and incidentally, I should say, while I was there, the United Nations were operating flights down to the Congo. The Belgians pulled out of the Congo, and there was all horrendous problems down there, massacres and everything else. And part of our role with the Royal Air Force was actually supporting United Nations operations. So we had regular aircraft going through every week, together with Canadian aircraft, going through into the Congo to support operations, and occasionally I had to go down on those flights to the Congo. We had an earthquake in Libya, which I got involved with because the Air Force, again, were mobilised to provide support to this earthquake at a place called Barchi. And, you know, those were sort of all interesting features of life at that time. From there, I was posted back to the UK, and having been involved with transportation, I was actually posted to an organisation then called the Ministry of Technology, although I was actually based at an RAF depot called Stafford 16MU. But I was responsible there for developing air freight. In the past, everything that had been put into boxes in the Air Force to go overseas had been designed to go by slow boat. Nowadays, everything was going by air. And the corollary to that was that at the same time, we were transferring aircraft and missiles from the UK to Cyprus because of our commitments to CENTO. We had a requirement, because of the threat posed in that area, we had to move fighter aircraft, so I was responsible for packing up all the missiles at Scampton and Leckenfield and shipping those out to Cyprus to support the Lightning aircraft that were there deployed. While I was at Stafford, the situation in the Middle East was getting a bit dodgy, and Aden in particular was a centre of a high lot of terrorist activity, and the fact that although the British government declared they were going to be pulled out, there was internal fighting between different tribes and groups, and there was a big requirement to plan for the final evacuation, and I was then sent out to Aden, to headquarters, Middle East Command in Aden, where I was responsible for supporting the forward airstrips that we had up in the desert, running convoys of munitions and fuel through to the forward airstrips, operating in support of the Sultan of Oman's Air Force, and this was the old Sultan, of course. In fact, one of the interesting things there was that once a month we used to have to pay the Sultan, and he was paid in Maria Theresa dollars. And if you were the duty escort officer, you signed for umpteen ammunition boxes filled with these beautiful Maria Theresa dollars, which were loaded onto an aircraft, flown up to Salalah, which is where he used to live most of the time in those days. And the paymaster actually handed over these coins, these beautiful coins, to the Sultan. I seem to remember that you could buy them from the accountant at the headquarters for about 7 and 6 pence each in those days, and they were beautiful coins. Again, because of the problems there, and I was involved in counter-terrorist activities. In fact, I was a flight commander on an internal security flight for much of my time there. Got shot up a couple of times and injured in a grenade incident. But that, by the by, was part of the job. I was also looking after one of the boat clubs out there as an informal thing. We used to run expeditions down to the bottom of the Red Sea to Perim Island with the troops, and this was great sport. And again, you know, like everything, one has a job to do, but one set out to enjoy it, hopefully. And I certainly thoroughly enjoyed my time in Aden. And I left in July 66, I think it was, and we finally pulled out of Aden, I believe it was in September 66. 67, correction, 67, 1967. I was posted from there back to my old alma mater at the Royal Air Force College at Cranwell, where I served as an instructor, and I was there teaching my own specialist subject of explosives and munitions. But inevitably, as an instructor at Cranwell, one was involved with all the other peripheral activities there. And again, a most enjoyable tour, totally different from anything else, but as an instructor, one was fairly busy and quite a lot of responsibilities. From Cranwell, I left there in 1969. I was posted to RAF Cottesmore, which was then in, or still existed, the county of Rutland, prior to its absorption into Leicestershire. I was posted in there as what's called OC Supply and Movement Squadron, which was an interesting tour. Insofar as we had something like 42 aircraft, one of the larger flying stations in the Air Force. We had 115 Squadron, which did flight checking and calibration, because they were operating Argosy aircraft, providing us with our own internal air transport support, which was excellent, because we also had 316 Squadron. It was a joint RAFRN Squadron, 360 Squadron, yeah, joint RAFRN Squadron, that operated all over NATO on electronic jobs. So we were able to support them with 115 Squadron. We were virtually running our own little air force, which was interesting. And again, that caught up with us. There was a major postal strike during the time I was there, and we ended up utilising our aircraft to undertake mail delivery services all around the UK, which was not only busy, but an interesting time. From Cottesmore in 1971, I was posted to an organisation then called the Joint Warfare Establishment, which was at Old Sarum near Salisbury. It was a rather unique organisation. It was based on the concept of joint service activity, where effectively we had a joint staff made up of Army, Navy, Royal Air Force, Royal Marines, together with Canadian and American officers on secondment. And our role was to examine all the joint plans that were produced for each, all the plans produced for each of the services, and look at them with a joint aspect so that we could see where there was maybe duplication of effort or where we could integrate better. We were called purple suited. And the nice thing about it was, in the time that I was there, we worked on what they called reverse catback. It's basically, and I was a blue suited RAF guy, I looked after Army, Navy, and Marine matters. I didn't look after Air Force matters. The delight of that was that if you saw something on the Army side that the Air Force had tried and abandoned, you could say, well, you know, not worth your while. Alternatively, you see something maybe the Navy were doing that could work in the Air Force, you'd bring that back to your own service. And we staffed all these joint papers, and we worked on various doctrinal documents and producing the joint service manuals. But in addition to that, it was also a school. And a very heavy workload there was involved in instructing NATO staffs on various aspects of jointery. And we had, I think, 12 NATO courses which ran throughout the year. We also looked after CENTO, Central European, South CENTO. CENTO was Turkey, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, Turkey, Pakistan, and Iran, I think those are the three in CENTO. Central European Treaty Organization, I can't be European, but anyway, that was the people. And on that basis, we used to go out periodically to Pakistan, to Iran, to lecture on jointery to the services there, and to Turkey, of course. And we worked very closely with the forces over there, and in fact, one of the particular interesting aspects of activity there, I was in Iran and got involved with some of their staff on developing emergency plans, and I was actually found myself in the end writing the Iranian earthquake disaster plan for them, which I believe was subsequently used to good effect. Never got any credit for it, other than learning to ski, you know, courtesy of the Shah, but that was fascinating, and the Iranians in those days were quite splendid people. I liked them a lot, but I say regular trips to Pakistan and Iran, and occasional trips to Turkey. From this splendid tour at Old Sarum, I then went off to my first Ministry of Defence tour, which was originally in London, but the department moved up to Harrogate in Yorkshire. It's known as SM29, which stands for Supply Management 29, but in practice I was responsible for munitions again, the safety aspects of munitions, the licensing, the storage categories of munitions that we could have throughout the UK and their transportation, authorising storage sites, inspection of storage safety standards, and the quantities of munitions you could have in one place. Obviously, you know, makes sense. You can't just store what you want. There's got to be rules and regulations for this, and I was responsible for maintaining those rules and regulations. At the same time, while I was there, it was decided we were going to pull out of Cyprus at comparatively short notice, and I then faced with having thousands and thousands of weapons coming back from Cyprus and having to find storage space for them in the UK, which was quite an interesting little exercise. And at the same time, we were looking ahead to various rule changes, which were going to tighten up the safety regulations, and in many ways that tour stood me in fairly good stead for things that were eventually to come. From Harrogate, I was lucky enough to be posted to a NATO tour in Germany to headquarters 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force. Now again, one must remember at this time we were still in the Cold War. The Warsaw Pact faced up to NATO across the whole of Germany, across the what was then known as the inner German border, stretching from North Cape, in fact, right down to the Mediterranean. And the whole of the NATO setup in those days was based on three major formations: AFCENT, Allied Forces Central Europe, which was our headquarters based in the Netherlands, effectively. The northern sector was looked after by AFNORTH, and also at Kolsås in Norway. And the southern part of NATO was looked after by headquarters AFSOUTH at Naples in Italy. Inevitably, it was necessary to maneuver between these people, and I moved between these various headquarters from time to time, and our other units. But in 2ATAF, we had a joint service organization there made up of the Royal Air Force, German Air Force, Dutch Air Force, Belgian Air Force, and before I left, we also had American Air Force in 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force. 4ATAF was in the southern part of Germany. There, I was predominantly responsible for airfield survivability, logistic planning, but the effects of simulated air attack on airfields, how soon we could recover, what the implications were for the various types of weapons that could be used, against safety, munitions, logistics, all of these things rolled into it, together with exercising. And again, part of my role there was an exercise planner for the sort of biannual NATO Wintex exercise, but again, that was nothing new. I had personally been involved with that from my old Sarum days, writing the incidents and testing it. But I was also part of what was called a tactical evaluation team there, where we would descend on a base, simulate accidents, simulate going to war for that matter, and just see how the various bases were able to respond and cope with the situation. And that was a fascinating time to be in Germany. It really was a most interesting and rewarding time. And in some ways, particularly my association, very close association with the Americans, it probably stood me in good stead for my next posting, which I know is the one that now interests you, when I was posted to Greenham Common. I arrived there on the 19th of May, 1980, which, if my memory serves me right, was about a month before we went public, about the missiles coming in. Of course, rumours were rife. And indeed, I knew before I was posted in that it was going to be an interesting and challenging appointment. But as I say, I was posted on the 19th of May, and I think it's interesting, at least I find it interesting, that when I arrived at Greenham Common, it was a scene of almost total dereliction. There was no other word for it. Some people may have seen a rather old film called 12 O'Clock High. It opens by an American coming back to the UK. He served in the UK with a bomber group during the war. He's come back to the UK and he's looking over the fence of what had been his airfield. And this fence was all rusty and derelict, great gaps in it. Grass was growing high on the airfield. There was grass growing through the cracks in the concrete, and the hangars looked as if they had never seen a drop of paint since the end of the war. Greenham Common looked a little bit like this. The perimeter, I believe I'm right in saying, we had a 9 or 10 mile perimeter fence at Greenham Common. Majority of it had been neglected. It was in a terrible state. Yes, the grass around the airfield, it was let out to a farmer who mowed it for hay. And by the time I looked at it, it certainly needed another cut. And to say the runway, although it was technically operational, it certainly wouldn't have taken any of the big heavy aircraft. And as I say, many of the buildings were in a pretty sorry state. Now, it's interesting at this point to reflect back on Greenham Common. it was built during the war. And at that time, there was a great clutch of airfields built for the invasion of Europe. Welford, which was a sister base, eventually, to Greenham Common, and I was also responsible for that, was built at the same time, as was Aldermaston, Harwell, Membury, lots of places across the south coast. These airfields were built specifically for the invasion of Europe. And the Americans indeed occupied Greenham Common during the war. They arrived during the war, and with very few gaps in between, there was American presence at Greenham from the war until, we're now in 1992, we're in November 1992, the base formally closed last month, so there's been an extensive American presence at Greenham Common. And indeed, at that time, the presence was represented by one lieutenant colonel, about a staff of a dozen. That's all that was at Greenham Common when I arrived. Having said that, there was a major and a staff of about 200 at RAF Welford further up the road, but Greenham was on what we would understand as the care and maintenance. And in fact, my predecessor had operated out of RAF Welford because the facilities at Greenham were so terrible. I had to move everything across from Welford to Greenham and start operating. When I arrived, I had an RAF warrant officer who the primary responsibility was looking after the munitions at Welford. I had an administrative officer, and I had a clerk, and that was it. So with the brief to prepare to develop the base to be converted to accept cruise missiles in the longer term, I really had an open-ended appointment. My terms of reference were simply to act as the Royal Air Force commander. There were three features only specified. One was that I was the landlord of the base, and therefore I was responsible for the real estate and anything that happened on that real estate. I was responsible for the security of the base at that time, and I was responsible for maintaining liaison with the media and with the local authority and with the local community. Gradually, as the situation unraveled, more and more responsibilities were added. I hasten to say it took a long time before staff levels caught up with what was realistically required. But in May 1980, it was an interesting place, but it certainly had a vast amount of work required to be done to bring it up to standard. It's interesting that at that time, having said the runway was operational, and it was, except for the biggest and most modern aircraft, because the base had not been used operationally for so long, we couldn't even find up-to-date plans and things of many of the facilities on the base. Now, this is unusual. I hasten to say this is very unusual. But PSA, the Property Services Agency, which is a civilian adjunct of the Ministry of Defence, responsible for all the works and maintenance on any Ministry of Defence property, any government property, whether we're talking about Regent's Park or whether we're talking about an airfield or we're talking about a naval dockyard or an armaments depot somewhere, PSA have overall responsibility. And Greenham had been upgraded to allow for the operation of fast jet aircraft several years, or no, actually maybe about 5 or 6 years before. It was connected to the UK national pipeline for fuel supply. Again, this is something which many people probably haven't heard of. In truth, maybe don't need to know about. But there is a network of pipelines all over the UK used by military and civilian population. So instead of having to send tankers into the base to bring in fuel, it comes in underground in a pipeline. And Greenham was connected to that pipeline system. So we had quite a lot of tankage on base as one of the contingency options for the use of Greenham in a war scenario was that it could be used for tanker aircraft, so we need a lot of fuel space. But looking for maps, looking for charts of the base and all its technical facilities, this was rather difficult. So one of my early tasks was actually to cash in on a local contact with the Royal School of Military Survey at Hermitage, which is conveniently just the other side of Newbury, and ask them to come in and produce a plan for me, which we did. And those were the first new maps of Greenham produced for a long time. And gradually, as the base developed, we produced overlays for these showing all the new facilities. But even PSA accepted it was a jolly good map. But we still, every time you put a JCB in the ground, you didn't know whether you're going to hit
well, we knew where all the fuel pipelines were, but you didn't know where you were going to hit electric cables, sewers, or whatever. It was quite interesting. But that was one of the first things, to sort out the basics of what we had and where it was, and assess the condition of everything. Now, in this regard, I was responsible through, or with PSA, for the works that were going to be required. NATO and the Americans basically were going to be paying for it. So we had to look at all the development plans, and this really was very much an ongoing feature of life. But in this first month or so there, it was absolutely chaotic trying to assess priorities, what was going to be required, and how we were going to achieve the desired results. Well, of course, the publicity about Greenham had gradually sort of gone from rumour to counter-rumour to factual statement. And once it was formally announced in the House of Commons, we had a visit on the 24th of July from the then Secretary of State for Defence, Francis Pym. And he came to Greenham Common, not so much to inspect the base, there was very little for him to see there, rather than getting an appreciation, but he came to talk to the good people of Newbury. And Newbury District Council arranged for a public meeting to be held at their largest venue, which was conveniently Newbury Racecourse. And I went with Francis Pym that evening from the base down to the racecourse. Now, at that stage, I must say that although there were protesters around, their numbers were comparatively insignificant. And by and large, there was no major problems. At this stage, we had nobody outside the main gate. These were people milling around generally, and the protest was directed, it appeared to me, more at Francis Pym than at myself as the RAF commander. This meeting was public for the Brits. It didn't involve the Americans, so there were no Americans there. But there were one or two protesters. But I say, basically, it was a very good meeting. It was packed. And the one thing that sticks in my memory from that particular meeting was Francis Pym, who was a very articulate speaker. I suspect a very astute politician as well. But in his introductory remarks, he made reference to the fact that there was a certain amount of protest about this and the fact that Newbury found themselves now in the front line of the media. But he said, he reminded everybody of insurance policies. He said, well, now look, we all pay insurance. We hope we're never ever going to have to cash it in. He said, I look on defence as a form of national insurance. But I look on these missiles as something more. And he referred back to all the work that had been going on between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. There are various organisations whose names escape me at the moment, looking at mutual balanced force reduction. I think that was the big buzzword at the time, MBFR, mutual balanced force reductions. And there were big arguments between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, mainly between the Americans and the Russians, to be fair, on the number of missiles, the balance of terror, the balance of missiles. And whilst there was a certain amount of agreement on the big strategic missiles, there should be some reductions, there was nothing that NATO had at that time which would counter the medium-range surface-to-surface missiles held by the Soviets. There was nothing at all. Consequently, cruise missile was seen, the GLCM, the Ground Launch Cruise Missile, was seen as a counter to this particular missile system held by the Warsaw Pact, for which at that time NATO had neither the defence or the comparable system. Cruise was introduced throughout NATO as a balancing factor. And going back to Francis Pym, he was talking about this in much more eloquent terms than myself. The bottom line of his argument was that if we get these missiles in, we have something which matches the other side. Newbury is one selected base. There'll be other bases in the UK. In fact, there's only going to be one other base in the UK at Molesworth. But they were going to be installed in Denmark, in Germany, in Italy, in Greece, as a balance to the missiles on the Warsaw Pact.